Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us now is Dan Gelston, the group president of CAE Defense and Security, that announced on Monday plans to acquire L3Harris's military training businesses for about $1 billion, including historic units like Link, DOS Aviation, and AMI. Dan, great to have you back on the show, and congratulations on the deal.
Thank you, Vago. Great to be here.
It really is. And true to your word, you said that you'd be growing your business organically as well as through M&A, and you guys are definitely doing the A part of that. And for those of us who are fans of the training business, it truly is historic because it reunites two really historic names in the business, right? CAE and Link, the original flight training business. And anybody who's familiar with aviation knows the integral role that Link trainers played in training pilots in World War II. I should say that as a young kid who used to go to the Air and Space Museum, when it opened, there was a room full of Link trainers. So that was one of the first times I felt like what it was like to fly an airplane as a little kid. This really expands your military aviation training business and certainly increases reach into B-21 that's going to be competed. I mean, the airplane's going to make its first flight, all things being equal, next year. Then also the next generation air dominance airplane, or the two big contracts that are out there. How does this capability turn into that reality, right? I mean, how does this fit into the broader strategic drive you have to expand your military footprint?
Yes, we're obviously very excited about it. And as you touched on it, it's really no better match for two businesses. This is a great home for the L3Harris military training and solutions business. As you mentioned, Link, the bulk of that business that we are buying with a glorious 90-year history and those famous blue boxes. Of course, now they kind of look like a kid's ride at a fairground, but absolutely vital, particularly in the World War II scenarios. So we're really excited to match the 70 years of CAE with the 90 years of Link. And particularly when you look at the paradigm shift, and we touched on this last time we talked, in the United States and its allies, as far as a strategy moving from asymmetric focused non-state actors to near peer threats, that really requires quite a bit more training, and not just training, but training in the digital environment across all five battle space domains. So space, air, land, sea, cyber. And when you look at how our two businesses fit, you really can see that through the focal point of those domains. They really match us nicely in air, I think solidifying our position as the leader in the air tier. They augment us in ground and naval, and they help provide entree into space and cyber. And you touched on a bit of that in the air. In particular, we've traditionally done a lot of helos, a lot of cargo, a lot of prop plane simulation and training, and they've classically done the fast jets, the fighters and the bombers. In sea would be another example, very exciting. We do quite a bit of surface training. So, ships, bridges, and things to that effect, where they have traditionally done subsurface, so working submarine training, again, a fantastic marriage. But in particular, when we look at those next generation platforms that are coming so much faster than they ever have before, they give us particular entree with their bomber and fighter experience and decades worth of classified work on B-2, a natural introduction into B-21 and that relationship with the prime Northrop Grumman. And then certainly with their F-16, F-18 work and the jet work they do, along with our initial F-22 training and F-15 training, I think we're in a great position for next-gen platforms, not only more F-35 potential work, but certainly sixth-gen and next-generation air dominance. So it's a wonderful marriage, highly complementary businesses where we see quite a bit of synergy, but at the same time, really moving that puck forward for us and filling the gaps, if you will, that we had in some of those tiers. And you put us together. I know it's overused, but I really think 1 + 1 will equal 3 here.
It certainly is an expansion of capability, right? Puts you guys into the ab initio training with DOS sort of on the ground up side, and on the hardware side of things with AMI, hardware and software side of it on AMI. How do all of these capabilities, Dan, fit into this sort of synthetic training, right? I mean, you mentioned this at the very top, right? And when you're going up against high-end competitors, range capabilities are limited, and there are even limits on what you can do and the kinds of training you can do. So there is a drive for these sort of vast joint synthetic training environments. How do these transactions help you in that drive to get you to that better place where you can do actually battle force training across the piece, all away from prying eyes?
Exactly. Particularly in the air tier gives us, you know, soup to nuts capability, I think a full solution set. And let's look at both of the pieces of the business you mentioned. In DOS, you get the initial pilot training, the live training in their Diamond airplanes, 20, 30 minutes outside of Colorado Springs for all the Air Force. Now, we do all that similar training and a bit more advanced into the intermediate stages in Dothan, Alabama, similarly down the road from Fort Rucker for the Army. So putting those together really gives us some critical mass to not only provide solutions such as to the United States Air Force, which just had an industry day and is looking at outsourcing more of that pilot training, where we're greatly positioned for it, but also internationally. There's multiple full flight operations centers being stood up in Europe, as well as the Middle East. And I think, again, with that Air Force and Army capability and that economy of scale you're going to bring with the supply chains and the like, you're going to really have some incredible capability there. Over in Oklahoma, you've got the AMI business, and they're experts at integrating cockpits and particularly their cabling and instrumentation. So that's vital for us, particularly in recreating the jets, the fast jets in the air tier. So having that capability is going to be key to understanding every aspect of the air tier, which is vital across all five domains, but connecting it together is the last piece. And we're actually a subcontractor to L3 right now on a $900 million prime of theirs called SCARS, Simulator Common Architecture Requirements and Standards. Quite a mouthful. But what does that do? That connects all 50 plus platforms that the Air Force has in their simulator architecture. So it in the cyber realm, cyber hardened, creates a network where all these different platforms can practice in a secure environment, like you mentioned, where the enemy cannot see exactly your tactics, techniques, and procedures. And you can really train across platform, almost platform agnostic, geographic agnostic, because they're going to be cyber hardened, linked around the world. In a full immersion, digital immersion scenario across all five domains.
Let me ask you, you mentioned cyber, and many more people are asking the question, hey, look, we spend $3 million to train each aviator, but are we investing enough money in resources to train the next generation of cyber warrior? Because at the end of the day, they are going to be as important and in some cases, maybe more important even than pilots. How do you see the cyber training business, given that, there just are not a lot of people? We have to train them up, and the quality of training, right? I mean, you need experiential base given the complexity of cyber warfare, I guess what I'm saying. How do you see growth in that market?
Yeah, certainly of the two, air quotes, newer domains, space and cyber, I really have a focus on cyber because, as you mentioned, hopefully we won't be actively in a shooting war in this near peer strategic scenario we are going forward in this great return of the great power competition. So, air, land, and sea is probably more on the training end as we go forward. But cyber, as we all know, in a Cold War scenario, the cyber war is hot every single day. There's intrusions constantly happening. There's offensive and defensive cyber happening on a daily basis. So I really see an importance on cyber. That's an area that not just affects the military, but infrastructure, banking, and power grids, and water supplies, you name it. And I would agree. I think we've had some really unfortunate breaches, particularly sensitive information. I mean, I've got a top secret SCI clearance, and I was one of those that, my information was broken into when the OPM breach happened a couple of years ago, and all my files for that top secret investigation were hacked into. So that's very important to me, and that's why I'm pleased that my organic capability is more focused on the platform and hardening the platforms. We actually won a cyber award at CAE for their KC-135. Work we've done, and then certainly a greater entree, particularly through that SCARS contract and some of the Air Force and DARPA work that L3Harris is doing, I think moves the ball forward for us. But certainly, if we get to continuing the march of inorganic, that would be an area that I'm looking at continuing to bolster, because the training side is something that I'm still looking at augmenting my capability in cyber training.
So at the end of the day, even though you paid 13.5 EBITDA, which some people, earnings before interest, taxes, and amortization, you still think that that was worthwhile, and you think you'll be doing more deals?
Absolutely. I think it's a great property. We've long admired the Link business for decades, and particularly the L3Harris competimate situation, if you will. We've been in for many years, either competing with them at times or partnering with them, like I said, on SCARS. And in particular, as a U.S. business, they have long had highly classified work, which CAE really didn't start doing heavily until they bought Reflectone in 2001. And even then, it was more at the secret level. It wasn't until a couple of years ago when we went from an SSA to a proxy where we could access TSSCI work. So we've made great strides on the heavily classified. L3 has been there for quite some time. And obviously, the programs like B2 and GBSD, we haven't touched on, but they're the training systems integrator for ground-based strategic deterrent, are very attractive to us. So a business that we really were interested in, it was a competition. There was others that saw how good this business was. I'm very comfortable with that 13.5 times multiplier, particularly when you look at it in light of the synergies, because we have so many similarities and complementaries in our business. You'll notice that we're about 10 times EBITDA with synergies, which I think Canadian, we're coming in about 35 to 45 million reoccurring. And I think that is imminently achievable. So certainly understanding a 10 times multiple, I'm very comfortable with this buy, and we're extremely excited about it. And you're right, we don't necessarily want to stop at CAE. Mark Perrant, my CEO, has made it very clear that he wants to lean forward coming out of the pandemic, take advantage of potential property fits that might be more affordable than they would have been otherwise. And I think he set up particularly his structure for financing these deals. You can see a portion of this deal, for instance, had PIPE investment, private investment in public equities. It gives us more flexibility to going forward. If the right property were to come, either on the commercial side or on the defense and security side, I still think we're aggressively positioned that it would be in a place to potentially continue this fantastic M&A streak we're on. I think this is the fourth one in 4 months, and this one in particular was the largest that CAE has ever done.
We've got about 30 seconds left. Two questions. Do you see any antitrust questions or any problems coming from government regulators? And second, there has been a commercial aviation slowdown. Obviously, that's the bulk of CAE's business. Any impact on your business and ability to do deals in the future?
Sure. On antitrust, no. Obviously, it's out of my control, but we've done quite a bit of work on this, looking at it for the past 6 months, actually. And when we look at our military training and simulation market, the top five players in it make up about a third of the overall revenues of the addressable market. Even post this acquisition, we'd be approximately 9% of the market share. So less than 10% and still in the number two position. There's a major OEM that sits in the low teens range still ahead of us. So one third the market and five players, we're still number two, less than 10%. I don't see an issue as far as antitrust. on the question with commercial, certainly commercial has impacted our business. Our commercial side, led by Nick Leontidis, is a dominant player in commercial. And there's no question, if you look at the financials, there was an impact there. But I think he has, with his commercial business, recovered much more quickly than anybody expected. In fact, you'll see quarter over quarter improvement through this third quarter. And especially if you look at the training, and you touched on this in the beginning, airline training, we're a leading indicator. All these pilots need to get back and get recerted, get in their time in the simulators before they start flying. So we're starting to see activity on the commercial air side. Well, we don't believe the full market recovery will happen for another 2, potentially 3 years. We're very bullish that it will be coming back, and we're going to be ahead of that curve. And he's also been balanced a bit by business aviation. Business aviation certainly has not taken the hit and recovered a lot quicker. In fact, it's within 10% of pre-COVID levels than the commercial side as far as commercial airlines. So that's an excellent position. He's very strong in business aviation, and that has certainly helped support that side of the business. So along with the financing structures that we've been able to put together for these M&A deals, I don't see, it's had an impact. A balanced portfolio has been helpful, but we haven't had as much of an impact on the defense side. And then along with the financing structures, I still think we're in a great position to take advantage of quality properties. If they're to come along in the next 1 to 2 years, we should be in a good position to give it serious thought.
Dan, thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Best of luck. Deal, I guess you're keeping your fingers crossed that it's going to conclude later this year, as you guys stated, right? It's going to be third quarter. Am I right about that? About thereabouts, pending regulatory approval? Second half, right?
Yeah, second half. I mean, hopefully later into the summer, pending regulatory approvals. But second half calendar year, I think, is a safe bet.
Thanks very much again. Break a leg and look forward to having you back on in the future. Thanks again. More than 521,000 Americans have died during the COVID pandemic thus far as state and local governments ease restrictions and air travel picks up. A positive jobs report with 379,000 jobs created in February comes as Congress prepares to pass President Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus package that has been approved by the Senate and is going back to the House for final approval. Joining us, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in sunny Washington, D.C. Guys, it's always a pleasure having you back on. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Vargo. Thank you.
Yeah, always a pleasure for us, Vargo.
Absolutely, Vargo. Thanks.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Ron, give us your sense on how the group Aerospace and Defense performed last week, right? I mean, another little bit of a roller coaster where people saw their portfolios were, down 7% and then sort of weirdly ended the day up or went down and stayed down, including some big names and big funds, right? I mean, Kathy Wood of ARK, somebody who's had a good run, has had a little bit of a down week as well, just to mention her. How did the group overall perform during the week?
Yeah, if you look across the aerospace defense group, the S&P was up just a smidge under a percent, maybe call it 0.8%. The defense stocks broadly were up 1% on the week, outperforming the S&P. And commercial aerospace did a little bit better. If you look at Boeing, it was sort of a broad benchmark. It was up 5% on the week. And then some of the smaller names, Spirit Aerosystems was up 10% on the week. And the aircraft lessors were up about 5% on the week. So commercial aero did better than defense, but both sides of the group outperformed the S&P. I think a couple of other things to note, after comments from the Fed at the end of the week, the yield was almost 1.6%. And if you compare that to where it was at the very beginning of the year, it was 0.9%. So on a percentage basis, the 10-year has gone up quite a bit. And then when you look broadly, I mean, one of the fears we've talked about is inflation. Oil prices for both WTI and Brent crude are now in the mid to high 60s. So it's quite a change since the beginning of the year. And then if you look across the commodities complex, you know, steel year to date is up almost 10%. Iron ore is up almost 20%. Copper is up 15%. Aluminum is up 10%. And then you know, at the broader commodities, corn's up almost 17%, soybeans 10%. So that's fueling, starting to fuel some of the, you know, the fears about inflation that you're, what you're seeing both on the yield curve and in the commodities complex.
Even though economists have sort of been saying that, look, we don't think there'll be inflation pressures, right? I mean, it depends on how the street is betting. And there are an awful lot of people with an awful lot of money who are betting that inflation will come back, right? I mean, so that's one of the hard parts, right? I mean, the minute that banks think they can make more money with inflation than without, you're going to find a lot of momentum. And this is coming, obviously, as you know, there is this sense that vaccine rates are picking up in many places, certainly in the United States. There's the Merck deal where vaccines, Merck is going to produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is a major move. And I we're told that more deals like that are underway to be able to actually get that volume of supply going. This comes, Sash, I know as a Brit, you know, the government's been doing a decent job getting shots in arms, although, as you know, Europe continues to still struggle, in fact, as infection rates are going up. All of that said, Sash, commercial air travel is picking up. Airlines are considering new routes off the beaten path. Interesting story there about BA, British Airways, looking at, you know, going to places that they don't normally travel on a regular basis. Talk to us about what your commercial forecast looks like, because your colleague Nick Cunningham does a terrific job tracking that, and was a very positive note he put out this week on that.
Yeah, I mean, we try to look at all of the available data points globally, and it was another pretty good week. Stuff is just ticking up in a way that, we had a bit of a real roller coaster actually. End of November, December, beginning of January, China had a big lurch down, but that's now reversing. And our view is that actually it's the degree to which China is stabilizing and after the, you know, the very severe lockdown that they had back in January and early February, Chinese demand has stabilized, starting to turn up again. And that actually is dragging pretty much the whole of the rest of the global market up at the moment. There's this sort of dichotomy, which is that if you look at the airline results, and airline, you know, financial results for 2020 have been coming out over the last 3-4 weeks or so, and they're all dire. I mean, you know, the numbers are measured in billions and they're all losses. But the, you know, the tone is just feeling a little bit better at the moment. And I agree with you, you know, the article talking about British Airways going and looking at offbeat routes. And this is almost certainly because a lot of the, you know, the big three airlines in Europe, international airlines group, Lufthansa and then Air France KLM, have historically been super focused on business travelers. And business travelers tend to fly very, very predictable, high density and super high yielding routes. So for the case of British Airways, it's, London, New York. It's not where they make all their money, but boy, they used to make a great deal of it. But they're now seeing routes which they can get similarly high yields, most often with smaller aircraft. And this comes back to everything that we've been talking about in the last, the last year, frankly, of long range narrow bodies, smaller wide bodies. You know, 787-8 probably comes into its own in this sort of route, but where, with a mix of business and leisure travel, but where the leisure travel is very, very high yield, they can actually make a really good, they think they can make a really good profit. And it's going to be fascinating to see airlines, you know, remake themselves, redesign themselves, as we have this very, very, frankly, very patchy recovery from coronavirus. You're absolutely right. You know, UK vaccine process is going extremely well at the moment. Europe is going astonishingly slowly. So how soon it will be before we in the UK can travel to Europe for a holiday, heaven knows. Summer's in the balance at the moment. But the airlines are sort of looking through that, and good for them. They're spotting opportunities way different to what their business model was pre-pandemic.
And is there, just to follow up on what Ron was talking about inflation concerns, do European investors and markets see that inflation worry as acutely as folks on Wall Street do?
No, it's nowhere near as acute. And I think you'll use the word acute is absolutely right. Of course, there is an awareness of it. Of course, that affects bond yields. But actually, if you look at the If you look at the moves in the stocks in Europe, it's still much more affected by, in particular, individual countries' responses to the vaccine, broader worries about civil aerospace demand. You know, I'm looking at Friday's close, and the European civil aerospace stocks are all off 5%. I mean, huge moves. Inflation is a second order problem, or it's perceived to be a second order problem in Europe at the moment. Right. That'll change. I'm sure it will. But it's not what everybody is talking about yet.
Richard, let's get your take a little bit on that demand and Airbus's decision to cancel the Norwegian order. I think in some respects that's not surprising, but normally it's the other way around. It's an airline canceling order, not the maker canceling an order. And that's raising questions about whether Boeing's going to follow. Give us a sense on that. And then feel free to gloat a little bit on your, hey, I told you it's going to be bullish and we're going to get back to normal sooner. So this gives you kind of a little bit of an opportunity to do that as well. I still think it's a little bit early for an end zone dance, but if you want to give us a little bit of body English, you're welcome to do that in your answer.
You're very kind. Thank you for the opportunity. And I look forward to doing the ultimate victory lap in the fourth quarter of 2022 when we are back to the 2019 peak. Still taking bets, people. Happy to do so. There are a couple of issues here on the Norwegian thing. Boeing has instituted a kind of halfway point, a purgatory, if you will, for its order book. Airbus doesn't have that purgatory. The purgatory over at Boeing, of course, is ASC 606 accounting adjustments, which basically say, hey, this was in our backlog. And obviously this is the backlog we file with the SEC and we have to pay a great deal of attention. However, we're also paying attention to ASC 606, which says you have to adjust your backlog for risk. And I'm not entirely sure what they put into that bucket, but it's a pretty significant bucket in the ASC 606 roster. It probably has the Norwegian planes in there, almost certainly. So the Airbus backlog is bigger, but perhaps a bit more brittle, if you will. There is no sort of holding tank of risk orders. It's either you're on or you're off. And historically, that's been the case. We all remember, those of us who were airplane geeks, remember the legendary ANA A340s, the Virgin A380s, and of course the Iraqi, I think, A310s that kept going even after the fall of Saddam Hussein.
That was a fabulous order. That was a legendary order.
We all collect these, Sash. They're just sort of these great moments in anecdote history, right? Every reason in the world to be optimistic. And, the Airbus Norwegian thing, that's just a function of a more brittle order book that hasn't been adjusted for risk. If I could add one last thing, I completely agree with Sash. I mean, this pandemic is resulting in a bunch of stuff that's really just an amplification of pre-existing trends, as we've discussed many times before. And point-to-point travel for yield maximization and cost control is just, one of those. It's just another step in the process of reality for the airlines saying, oh, right, market share is stupid. Volume is stupid. Let's just focus on, what do you call it again? Oh, yeah, profits. And you're going to see more and more of this, and it's going to impact fleet mix and therefore aircraft, because, frankly, this is a place where Airbus is simply in better shape. The C-Series A220, I'm still calling it the C-Series, that is just exceedingly well-placed for this environment. And so is the A321neo, of course, which I know is another topic of our conversation later in the podcast. But, Boeing really needs to do something in terms of meeting this new market challenge in the future.
Speaking of that, Ron, excellent segue. Richard, thanks very much. Boeing has told the European Air Safety Agency that it's got, that the A321 or the XLR version, the long range version of the A321neo, should not have a fuselage fuel tank. Those are problematic. I think the world sort of turned away from them in the wake of the TWA 800 disaster, when an unused fuselage tank may have had fuel vapors in it, and a sensor caused the airplane to explode, even though some people think it was shot down, which is a completely debunked theory. at the end of the day, is this more about, right? I mean, every certification authority asks manufacturers for their opinion. This is a game that Boeing and Airbus have been playing a long time of sort of deriding each other's products, right? I mean, Boeing was saying, oh my God, how do you get people off an A380? It's fundamentally unsafe. You know, you can get them off because you can get them off the airplane, right? At the end of the day, is this more of Boeing sort of trying to delay this game-changing airplane from going into service in the hopes that it can match it with a design of its own, given that pressure is building up? What's your sense of this as an aeronautical engineer?
Yeah, of course, that would be my first take on this. I mean, you learn from past failures, obviously, right? I mean, this industry writ large has done that quite well, almost over the last century, right? So, the potential issues around a fuselage tank, I mean, they're known and they're addressable. So I don't think there's any other way to interpret it than Boeing trying to slow things down, to Richard's point, because they don't have anything to compete with it, right? I mean, the A321 complex, if you will, between the LR and XLR have outsold the 737 MAX 9 and 10 by 5 at least. Boeing is, trying to get the Dash 10 to market, and they're dealing with the 777, and now they're talking again about maybe doing this middle of the market thing. So I think anything from their point of view to try to slow it down, obviously, would be, good for them. That said, however, frame it this way, those in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. As they try to certify the 777X, EASA will have something to say about it. Airbus might have something to say about it. And oh, by the way, that airplane did have a fuselage failure when it was doing pressure testing, right? So it just, the back and forth on this, I don't think is productive for anybody. So anyway, that's my take.
Sash, your sense, and I know, Richard, you've got another comment. Go ahead.
I think it's astonishingly bad taste and deeply cynical. Personally, I completely agree with Ron. People in glass houses should not throw stones. And actually, respected companies in the aviation industry should not be competing on the basis of safety or allegations of lack of safety by your counterparts. It's a really, really dangerous thing there. Let's be practical about this. The entry into service for the A321 XLR is 2023. So let's assume that by Boeing muddying the waters, they can delay that by a year, which is entirely possible if the FAA starts to look at it in very, very differently, if EASA starts to look at it very differently, even 18 months. So let's say 24, possibly even 2025. Boeing's not going to have a product ready within half a decade of that unless they start now. So what's the point? Cannot impose a delay that is remotely material enough to get any competitive advantage back.
Richard?
Yeah, strong agreement with my colleagues, extremely strong. Nothing creates doubt in the air transport system like any effort to compete on safety. It is just dumb as dirt. Don't do it. And, Airbus, of course, has been guilty of this in the past with their ridiculous four engines for long haul and four right. engines for safety thing back in the 340 days. But here, Boeing is guilty, and they need to stop immediately because, as Satch says, it will have no impact. And besides, they're in a race, like Satch says, the stupidest thing in the world is to denigrate the other racer when you're up late pounding tequila shots rather than actually competing.
Moving on. Very quickly, we heard from Dan Gelston at the top of the show from CAE on its deal with L3Harris. And obviously, we've got a Bombardier question on Outlook, as well as the company has shed a lot of product lines. It's gone through a bumpy ride. Ron, why don't you start us off on the L3Harris deal, and then Richard, give me your sense on what we heard from Bombardier, and then Sash, I'm going to go to you and Thales and Dassault in a minute. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, sure. This week, CAE bought the simulation business from L3Harris. It's a good fit for them, honestly. If you look at the economics of the deal, how they financed the deal, just in the numbers, it turns out to be accretive relatively rapidly. And if you look at what CAE has been trying to do over time, growing its presence in the defense market, in particular the U.S. defense market, this helps them do that. I think one of the frustrations among investors with CAE was that their U.S. defense business kind of stalled. They had a good start and then sort of stalled. This, you know, gives more momentum behind it and definitely more breadth and depth of that business. My understanding is they'll be opening up, you know, a Washington ops office and doing kind of everything. And, you know, kind of from a framework, I look at it, you know, sort of akin to when, you know, way back when Finn Mechanica did DRS, a similar idea that you'll have this U.S. operation for CAE. So the market looked at it favorably in it, and I think it's potentially a good strategic move.
Hang on a second. Let me bring Sash in here for a minute, because you did mention Leonardo DRS. Sash, what did you make of the statement from Leonardo after we had taped last week? Thanks very much, Ron. Great reminder that it was going to spin off its DRS business and maintain a stake in it. What did you make of that? Because DRS, if memory serves correctly, may be about 20% of Leonardo's total revenue, but it constitutes a large part of the company's profits.
And that's the problem. And the, you know, the associated problem for Leonardo has been that its stock market multiples simply don't reflect the value of all the assets, let alone the value of DRS in it. So I think this is, you know, this is financial engineering, but it's very much a function of long-term management frustration with the valuation the equity market puts on the stock, and you know, highlighting what the value of DRS is in a U.S. stock market listing is a very, very logical way to I think, you know, call a lot of people's bluff actually about how the whole of Leonardo should be valued. It's going to be very interesting to see, you know, whether the DRS business then trades at a discount because Leonardo retains a shareholding in it, whether ultimately somebody comes along and makes Leonardo an offer they just can't refuse in terms of buying the whole of DRS out, because, you know, there's a lot of hot money sloshing around various SPACs in the US market at the moment, and DRS would be a very, very good candidate for that. But I think would be a strategic reversal for Leonardo. So there's still quite a lot of delicate navigating to go on this one.
Richard, why don't you give us your sense on sort of Bombardier? You know, company's been through a bouncy time, and you wanted to comment on what the company had to say.
Yeah, you know, as Brother Ron has pointed out, we've now got a truly pure play, publicly traded upscale business jet prime that hasn't been tried. And so, of course, they're completely tied to the fortune of the large cabin business jet market. And so, you know, their financial projections, you know, very reasonable, but of course, completely dependent upon stuff that's beyond their control. You know, I mean, if you want to make God laugh, tell them your financial projections in that kind of environment, right? If everything goes okay in terms of the usual metrics, the usual corporate profits and equities markets, and of course oil prices and whatever else, the usual drivers behind large cabin business jet demand, if everything goes okay with those, they'll be fine. If something happens that disrupts that, then you got to wonder what happens to this company. All it does is one thing: large cabin business jets. That's it. And you look at the wholesale sort of chain of destruction or chain of whatever you want to call it that led here, and obviously this past week or two, you've had the death of Learjet and of course the death of or pausing, quote unquote, of De Havilland Canada, which had been sold to Viking Stroke Longview. You know, you've got this long death of so many Canadian and Canadian adjacent aircraft programs, leaving us with what to do about the large cabin business jets, and is that survivable? Really interesting moving forward on that.
Ron, briefly, do you want to make any comment on that before we move on to Thales, Dassault, and the F-35?
Yeah, and just quickly, and to Richard's point, I mean, I think it's, you know, Bombardier Aerospace is where good programs go to die. Anyway, I would add, will they have the pricing discipline And one of the issues the industry, I think, you're following the business jet industry for a long time, one of the complaints about Bombardier business jets was that they weren't as disciplined as maybe some of their competitors are on price. To get to the financial targets that they have to be disciplined on price. And then two, without the other programs, they have as much leverage with the supply chain that they used to have, because their volumes with the supply chain will be much less. And to get to the margins that they hope to, you got to take cost out somehow. So there's a natural learning curve, but also you have some leverage with the supply chain that'll help. And then the third point I would add is, as we've mentioned many times, that the strong got stronger and the weak got weaker through the downturn. Gulfstream is coming out of the pandemic a strengthened, very, very, very meaningful, right, prestigious player in this industry, right? So that's the competitive landscape that they're up against.
If I could just add one thing to that, this week or upcoming quickly, there's the very real prospect of the third player in the high-end business jet market snapping back, Dassault Falconjet 6X, about to fly, and rumors of a new high-end product launch from them too. They've been really quiet. Numbers are trending downward. They've been sort of the very weak third player in the upscale business jet market, but they've got a defense side, and that defense side is doing pretty damn well. So if they divert the cash from defense to Falconjet, they can come roaring back and represent a major problem for Bombardier.
Richard, twice in one podcast, a perfect cue up sash. Thales and Dassault both reported, and when Dassault reported, it also had some pungent, acerbic, candid comments about SCAF, the Franco-German fighter program. Walk us through what Thales told us, what it expects, and what Dassault told us, and what that portends.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to come back to Dassault in a second, but I mean, Richard's absolutely right. People have almost written Dassault off as a biz jet player. He's down there producing 20 odd aircraft a year at the moment, so who cares? But in a year's time, they'll be selling the Falcon 6X, and in 3 years' time, there'll be another aircraft as well. And I think that's going to cause problems for everybody concerned. And you're absolutely right. This is a cross-subsidy game. You use your defense cash to rebuild your civil product. Let's just think about, Thales for a second was remarkably straightforward, but it really shows quite how strong the European defense rearmament story is. Thales had their best quarter for orders for, we reckon, at least 12 years, probably longer. In fact, yeah, definitely longer, because it's just a smaller business then. 9.3 billion of orders, and a lot of large orders. And what's really interesting is the degree to which the focal, the industrial weight of Thales has changed over the last 5-6 years. If you look at the company 2015, their big backlog was Middle East and Asia, and it was basically systems and weaponry and support for the Rafale fighter contracts, Qatar, Egypt, India in particular, and some Mirage 2000 upgrades. Now, the biggest single component of their backlog two-thirds of their backlog is, what I call mature Europe. Well, actually, Europe is a mature defense market, but that now dominates the backlog. And I think that just shows how over the last couple of years, European orders have been coming in much faster than live with them. They've been consuming their Far East, Middle East orders relatively steadily. The Rafales have been delivered out, but it's really, it's looking a very different company in terms of what they're selling in Europe. A lot of naval systems, particularly for the German MKS 180 program, but also sonars, mine warfare systems to France and the UK. And this is actually probably a rather higher multiple business than it was when it had some fairly volatile exports. Dassault, you've got to remember, Dassault is a customer for Thales, but it's also Thales's biggest shareholder. It owns 20%, 26% of it. It's a peculiarly French construct, and it's very political of itself. The Dassault numbers, yeah, they were okay. Their guidance for 2021, yeah, fine. Not going to do a great deal. They're going to deliver about 25 Rafales and about the same number of Falcons. What was really interesting about Dassault was the comments that they made, as you say, about SCAF, the Franco-German Spanish fighter. And there was something of a sort of feeding frenzy by the media on the call on Friday. It's very apparent that the bust up between France and Germany over SCAF, over industrial leadership, over technology sharing, over intellectual property is bitter. I mean, it's an, you know, this is not something that gets easily swept under the carpet. Dassault gets, you know, says, we've made all the concessions that are needed to Germany. They blame Germany fair and square. I mean, they say we can work with Airbus Defence and Space, which is the German bit of Airbus. We can work with them fine, but the problem is Germany and Germany politically. And I came away with the view that SCAF is by no means assured at the moment. I think that the French or some people in France would be happy to play for a break, and they feel that they could go it alone. That's pretty dangerous, but it's a mark of how bad the relationships are with Germany at the moment. The thing that really worries me, though, is that it looks like a German sign-off of the next phase of the development program might be delayed, certainly until the summer, and possibly even until after the German elections in October. And if that's the case, SCAF has just lost nearly a year. And all the time this is going on, the Anglo-Swedish-Italian Tempest program is just moving on pretty steadily at the moment, under the radar screen, much less political. And, you know, it's entirely possible that Tempest could have a flying demonstrator and actually an in-service date that is so far ahead of SCAF that you slightly wonder why the French and the Germans are playing on this one. But it was a really remarkably frank and open discussion of the, you know, the wounds and the injuries that have gone on in the SCAF program. Really, you know, firing multiple shots across German bows that, you know, the French don't need to put up with this.
Richard, I think we even discussed about 3 or so years ago that we thought that this was going to be a potentially problematic program for just those reasons. Time is running short, and I have to get everybody's sense on the extraordinary conversation that Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution had last week with the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, the Washington Democrat, Adam Smith. I commend everybody in the audience to listen to it because it's Adam Smith, a strategist across the wide span of not just foreign policy, but also weapons acquisition. And in it, he has some very, very pointed comments that he made about the F-35, effectively that it may be time to stop throwing good money after bad on the program, that it may not make sense to have a singular airplane for the entire American tactical fighter force, and also concerns about the program not delivering. His comments are the latest that come. We heard from CQ Brown raising the need for another airplane. Other air leaders have said that. And if you talk to folks on the Hill, they think that the dynamic is shifting against the program. Concerns that the engine may be out of power and still have challenges, questions about the core computer, and also that the cost per flying hour may not be reduced. And one of the things that Chairman Smith said was, hey, listen, don't tell me that you can buy more, you know, that if I increase volume, I can buy it cheaper. He said, fundamentally, the question is whether we should be buying any more of them, right? That the program will continue, but we may not need as many of them. Richard, how do you see this? Just want to go quickly around the horn now.
You know, I think every so often we get our knickers in a twist, if you will, about the F-35. And, you know, sure enough, it was probably in retrospect a bad idea to go down the path of a ultimate Swiss Army knife fighter plane that satisfies the needs of everybody somewhat and nobody particularly greatly. But what's the art of the possible here? You know, let's do a sort of decision tree. Okay. Do you need fighters for the next 8 or 10 years? You probably do in terms of maintaining force structure, because it's been a long time since anyone started recapitalizing those Reagan era fighters at the needed rate. Okay, so we're talking about moving down to a new combat aircraft 8 to 10 years, but we got to keep building stuff for the next 8 to 10 years. What are the alternatives? Well, the Navy already found one. They just keep going with Super Hornets. Probably see it put back into the budget yet again for the umpteenth time. Marines have no choice because they've got, you know, 10 useless amphibious assault ships without the F-35B. So just keep going with the F-35B. Now that leaves the question of what happens with the Air Force in the 8 to 10 years it takes to come up with a replacement program. F-16s, F-15s, or, oh, screw it, let's just keep going with the F-35A for another 8, 10, 12 years. I'm not so sure I see a whole lot of alternatives unless you can really accelerate NGAD or something else to start entering production in that 8 to 10 year time frame. And I'd say good luck with that.
I think it's right. I mean, I think it's a very, very good point. I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit, right? I mean, the airplane does a lot of things better than its preceding aircraft, right? In terms of having stealth, in terms of having data fusion capabilities, being able to be a very, very powerful sensor node, right? Sure. But the whole question is, all of the other things and the cost per flying hour, right? I mean, an F-16, for example, is much, much cheaper to fly, even though it's a little bit less, even though it's less capable, you know, more capable as a bomb truck, right? Although Lockheed would tell you that they have a heavy payload capability on the F-35 as well with external stores when stealth is not as important. Ron and Sash, do you guys want to take a quick bite at this as well? Because I think that underlying Chairman Smith's message was, right, this is not an immediate thing. They're not going to pull the plug. But that I think we see the foundations being laid for a shift in direction, maybe might be a better way to put it. Ron and Sash, really quick.
Yeah, so I think Richard's exactly right. I mean, we've heard this before. And I think anybody that's been following this program since its days is, you know, what JAST to go all the way back. There was always the doubt that, you know, the Swiss Army concept might not be the best way to go. That being said, however, if you look at the acquisition cost of an F-35, they brought that down pretty meaningfully, right? So if you look at the acquisition cost of an F-35 versus an F-16 or an F-15, it's not all that different. And the cost per flight hour is more. If you look at the history of the military and how they do their budgeting, they've been very good at separating support costs out from acquisition costs, right? That's the whole reason why Everybody sleps everything for years and years and years, because, you know, why buy the new one if you can just spend a fortune maintaining the old one, right? So I don't necessarily, you know, buy that argument either. So Smith makes some valid points, but, you know, this is going to be a really, really difficult field to hoe.
Sash, we're very tight on time. Last thought.
This news flow comes at just the wrong time. F-35 is in competition for two major European countries, Switzerland and Finland. Both are very, very sensitive about precisely the area that Smith's identified, cost per flight hour. If you've got the American customer and you know, overseas people will not differentiate between a politician and somebody from the Pentagon. You know, you're all representing the United States of America, and it's the United States of America selling this thing. So if you've got somebody of nature saying the cost per flight hour is unaffordable, that I think people are going to, you know, I thought it was, Finland was going to go F-35. I think this might be the death knell for F-35 in Finland. And I think it gives the Swiss every opportunity to go for Rafale.
I'd flip that around. I think you're right in Switzerland, but at the end of the day, Finland shares a common border with Russia, right? So the dynamic may be a little bit different there, but I accept that, right, folks will be going back, sharpening their pencils and looking at it, especially since the Swiss have said cost per flying hour is absolutely critical. Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great day today. Have a great week. Looking forward to having it back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vago.
Yeah, really enjoyed it, Vago. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.